Hi listeners, it's Lucy. Please don't scroll ahead. This is a very quick message, I promise, to ask a very easy favour. At the end of each episode, as the credits roll, you'll hear a request from us to rate and review the show. Now, for those of you that are awesome podcast listeners rather than podcast makers, you might actually have no idea what a huge difference those things make. A significant factor in the visibility of a podcast on almost all listening platforms is down to the number and quality of ratings and subscriptions. So, if you are one of our dedicated listeners, hi, I know some of you as far away as Australia, so thanks. If you're currently not driving your car or changing a baby's nappy, can you please just look down at your phone right now as I'm talking and hit subscribe and 5-star rating? Both of them are on the homepage of the show and they are both only a one-click job. But oh my God, what a lot of joy and gratitude I would feel at those one clicks. It makes such a difference to the show's potential to keep going. Now, enjoy the episode and thanks for listening.
You're about to hear a brief conversation with an incredible artist. Part autobiographical journey, part literary analysis, and part late-night chat in the theatre bar. This is Hear Me Out.
And I'm your host, Lucy Eaton. Please welcome to the stage, Antonia Thomas.
Spoke before, I had just headed out to LA, and it was really interesting sitting down with people over there and talking to them about what's, you know, how the strike has affected everything. I mean, I'm so surprised with just how, like, the extent to which it's affected our industry here in the UK. Like, I know that, of course,
we're interlinked,
American money,
but,
of course we're interlinked, but I would have thought we would have had more that wasn't so dependent on them.
Was it also because the sense I got was this whole camaraderie thing as well, though, of people being like, I know I can do stuff, but I feel like maybe I shouldn't do stuff. Like, I think there was like an icky feeling around it as well. And people were like, what are people going to judge me for saying yes to?
100%. I mean, I did something last year that was technically a British project, equity contract, but because it was Apple, there was like, it came and went and we weren't allowed to talk about it because it just in solidarity didn't seem like the right thing. So
what was it? You can talk about it now.
It was called Still Up. Yeah, I can talk about it now. It's called Still Up. It's on Apple. It's great.
Great, go watch it.
Go watch it. Like a really fun little rom-com, and some people saw it, I think, but like not
That's
really
so
many.
Tough when you've given so much time to something, and then it just sort of like. Anyway, okay, so let's move from the screen realm into the theatre. And tell me, Antonia, what is your favourite speech that you would like to talk to us about today?
Okay, well, my favourite speech... Okay, I haven't done theatre in a really long time. I've done 10 years. So my favourite speech, and also the speech that I've done the most recently, I think, because therefore that feel kind of the most connected to, is a speech from a play called Shooting Hedda Gabler by Nina Siegel. A really, really amazing play, new writing, Nina's take or offering on a kind of a modern day take on Hedda Gabler.
And you did this at the Rose Theatre Kingston last year, was it? End of last year?
Yeah, end of last year. September, October time. An amazing opportunity. That was one of the pros that came out of the strike for me, because I was supposed to be doing something for screen and everything stopped, and then this play came along and I had the space to do it and read it, and it's the most compelling piece of writing I've read in such a long time.
So have there been other instances where you've almost come back and done a theatre, well, or even in America or in Canada, has there been a point when you've almost done some theatre?
Definitely. I mean, you know, like I have auditioned a couple of times for pieces, but I guess as well it's tricky. Like, when you start down one road, you start getting more of that thing, and you have to make a really concerted effort to go, I'm not going to take any of the things that are coming off the back of doing more of the, you know, screen stuff, and put a pause on that and say, I actually want to do theatre.
Yeah.
And I did that. And now, like, turning around and going, it was 10 years ago that I did that, and I did a play, I did a play at the National, and that was amazing, and I loved it.
What was that?
It was called Home. Mm. It was a verbatim piece.
Oh, interesting. Can you explain for the listener, in case any of our listeners don't know what a verbatim piece is? Because that's really interesting.
Yeah, verbatim is basically like it was a series of interviews that were collected, that people did, and verbatim is basically to perform those interviews exactly as the person has spoken them, basically.
Did you have earphones in? Or did you
we
just learn it as they
no,
did?
No, no, had to learn it as.
London Road is a very famous example that some people might have heard of a verbatim, although that was then made into music as well. But the person who wrote London Road then did something that I remember auditioning for, and in that one they were going to have earpieces and they wanted you to literally almost hear it and
parrot it,
yeah, a split second with a split second difference. So in my recall, you had to do the tech. You had to basically do a recall with the earphone in and try and, you know.
Oh my God, wow, that's nuts.
So interesting, so weird. But okay, so yeah, so that was the last thing you did at the National.
Yeah, that was the last, that was the last thing. Oh no, I mean, I did that and then I think I did a play at the Hampstead called Elephant, but that was, that was like the last time that I went, I won't stop, let's do some theatre. Yeah. And then it was interesting because people were like, well, you've only done screen, so you can't do theatre. And then I had to work really hard at kind of convincing people that I could.
So that's really interesting as well. I actually saw you'd said that in another interview somewhere, that there's a snobbery, like, in the industry that goes both ways.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit more about what that is?
Yes, there is. It doesn't matter if you've trained. Like, you know, I went to Bristol Vic, I trained in theatre, I thought that theatre was going to be the thing that I focused on, my bread and butter, and it just so happened that a TV thing came along and took me down that route. But then...
Which was Misfits, wasn't it?
Which was Misfits, yeah. Mm. And regardless of people knowing that you've trained, they are just like, well, but do you... You've just been doing telly for ages, so do you know how to support your voice? Do you know how to hit the back of an auditorium, all of that kind of stuff? And
which is slightly fair, I think, only in so much as we do lose those skills.
Totally,
like I feel sometimes that when I've had a break, like even now, like I haven't done a big theatre show since pre-COVID, and I even start to go, can I do it? And I know I can.
Yeah.
I know I can. But you know, they are skills that you sort of need to. You need to get
you
back
need to
into.
You keep working them. It's a muscle. And actually, when I came back and did this, I was like, "Oh my God, can I do this again?"
Well, yeah. How did you find it? How were those like skills? Getting those skills back.
It did feel like riding a bike. I was like, right, I've got to do my voice exercises again. I've got to come in, you know, do the warm up, do all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But like, it was like riding a bike. And luckily, it wasn't the Olivier. You know, the size.
Well,
but
I was about to say,
like...
the Rose Theatre is big.
It's quite big. It's,
like,
yeah,
I
it's
think
like
that is quite a... The Rose Theatre in Kingston is, like, a sizable space. So I think, don't do yourself a disservice there. I think if you can, like, jump back into theatre and do that space, then, like, I think you've got the
skills. Yeah, it's not... It was bigger than I thought it would be. But then also there was something quite intimate, even though it was big, about the space. So it didn't feel too daunting for whatever reason. But yeah, no, it was... I mean, there were definitely moments when, like, our director was like, okay, everyone just needs to pitch up a bit. You're like, right.
And you're like, me?
me? Talking about me? Yeah.
That's always very kind when they're like, generally, guys, you all need to speed up your lines a bit. And you're like, I know, that's to me. So, okay, so back on the play itself, can you tell our lovely listeners what the play... So you said it's a sort of modern take on Hedda Gabler, but the story is super interesting. So can you give a bit more detail on what happens in that play?
Yeah, so I guess the quick-potted idea of Hedda Gabler is that, you know, woman in 19th century Norway who feels trapped within her circumstances, trapped within her marriage, and has no way out, basically. And I think... Nina, the writer, wanted to update that idea into and place the characters into an environment that a modern day audience could still understand the idea that a woman could be trapped. And so, quite depressingly, she pinpointed the entertainment industry as an arena for that. and the kind of protagonist. They're all of the characters are called the characters from Hedda Gabler. So the protagonist, Hedda, is a Hollywood actress who in her youth was famous and has sort of out of kind of like bad choices and aging and the pressures of the industry and the pressures of just sort of generally the pressure. It's about how women are sort of treated by this industry, essentially, and the pressures of that. She kind of finds herself in a position where she's totally fallen off the rails and doesn't know how to get herself back. And she is offered an opportunity by a Norwegian auteur director to come to Norway and to film the film version of Hedda Gabler. Mm. And for her, she's like, well, this is what... Because she's a good... The idea is that she's a good actress.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
has just... Her circumstances have led her to being depressed and drinking yeah. and yeah. getting a bad reputation. And so she's like, this is the moment. You know, no one's offering her anything. And everybody knows that Scandinavians make amazing films. Like, and so, you know, like, this is going to be the artist, you know, a moment of sort of artistic integrity. And she gets to Norway and this sort of very strange environment where no one's speaking to her in English and there's no script. And so, you know, she's all ready. She's got her text, Hedda Gabler text ready, and she's ready to go. And the director turns out to be a kind of, well, I don't want to name names, but a kind of manipulative man who is after, there is no script. He doesn't want anybody to act. He wants people to be. So he's chosen her because of the state that she's in and because she's trapped.
Yeah.
And he wants her to live out her truth and to therefore become on camera and to therefore become Hedda Gabler. And so then he manipulates each of the actors. So he brings in... There's the character in the original script, Eilert, who is her ex-lover, who kind of comes back into her life. And the director ends up casting the actor that's going to play Eilert as a guy who's her ex-boyfriend.
Yes, yes.
And he just, like, at each moment, he's sort of, like, cranking the gears and creating the most unsafe environment, basically, for the actors to play in until they lose their minds and she ends up becoming Hedda Gabler and sending Isla off to kill himself and then killing himself.
Spoiler alert. It's a tragedy.
But it's a tragedy,
it is such an interesting idea. I love it. So what's the speech that... you've picked? Where in the play is that moment?
So it's a quite an intense speech. It comes towards the very end of the play, and at the moment that it comes, the director has kind of manipulated her into playing out versions of like the most of the story that he kind of wants on screen. Mm. And just before this, she has actually had this kind of really self-destructive night with Eilert, the ex, and he is depressed and an alcoholic and all of this stuff, and she's basically encouraged him to like leave everything and just go and just see if you can survive out in the Norwegian like wilderness in the snow. And when you read the play, it makes more sense, but she's just like, you don't need anything, you don't need any of your possessions, go and be reborn,
be at one with the earth.
And they're drunk and she like sends him out into the snow and he basically dies. But she's sort of got herself into this headspace where she actually thinks that she was trying to save. It's just a very, very like, they've all kind of lost their minds. The director, once she's sort of done that moment, comes in and he's like, right, now it's the time to practice the suicide scene. We're going to practice your death. Oh. And he has this blank firing gun and he's like, you're going to shoot yourself and I want to see you die and I want to see the truth of you dying. And she doesn't want to do it because at this point, like, her grip on reality is just all over the place and it feels she feels like she's actually going to kill herself. But she does it, and then he's like, well, I don't believe that, so do it again and do it again and do it again. So then you watch her shoot herself again and again and again and die again and again and again. But then by, you know, the last time that she's done it, she just, it's this, like, a complete disassociation and she... Yeah. And she's just like, I don't know, what more do you want from me? What am I not doing? I can't actually die. Like, what more do you need to feel like this is worth the
real,
basically. And that's the moment that the speech comes in. It's, I mean, I won't be able to do it as was done on stage because it's a pretty heightened...
Yes, no, we do not need you to.
Emotional state. But it's an interesting moment because it's sort of like encapsulates everything that she feels, the very reason why she's there, basically. Every reason that she feels trapped by the industry and... her life and how and what has led her to this moment, basically.
Yeah. God, it sounds so good.
It's really amazing. Playing Nina Siegel is an incredible
playwright. Cool. How easy was it to not get swallowed up in it yourself? I mean, a third layer of meta. Not that hopefully you're not in as sad a state as the header of that play, but I guess the thing about theatre is, like, you go in at the beginning and you do mentally, like, go into that
you're on it
and certainly at least within a scene you're like in that scene and you play it out in real time. And, you know, sometimes I mean, I would say I'm an actress who I am not particularly Daniel Day-Lewis about things at all, but occasionally you just can't help but have an experience where you're in the middle of a scene and it's playing out and by the end you're like, whew, God, I've really...
How
did you find the experience of, I guess, doing something like that, having come from, I guess, the more bitty experience of screen acting?
I mean, I have to say, just generally, that was the thing that felt like, oh my God, I love theatre. And I've missed it.
Great.
You know, just this idea that you just get to go and do it and there's no stopping and every night is going to be different. And this play, I mean, just to speak quickly, on the meta levels of the play, like, as a woman in this industry, there was a lot about it that, like, yeah, my life and circumstances, thankfully, are very different to their characters. But, like, there's a lot in it that you're like, oh, God, it's so depressing in this industry for women. Like, what we're, you know, the kind of standards that we're held to and all of that sort of stuff. So, like, you know, there was certainly... it's not a character that is hard to relate to.
Yeah. Yeah,
her choices are, but, like, you know, like, kind of see
the
core she's got to and why.
Kickoffs are easy to relate to, yeah.
Absolutely. And, like, every night people would come and go, that was the most intense thing ever. How are you, like, mentally stable? And I think, like...
You're like, I'm just so thrilled to be back at the theatre.
Yeah, I was like, I'm just loving myself. No, it was very intense. And there were some nights that we'd be on it. And Christian Rubeck, who... is just, I mean, first of all, the cast, I have to say, were the most incredible cast I worked with in the longest time. Such amazing actors. They're wonderful. And they're wonderful friends now.
Great.
As well, which is so nice. Thankfully, because the piece is so dark that it would have been really difficult if there had been anyone in the cast that wasn't very nice, I have to say.
My experience has been the darker the play I do, the happier the cast backstage.
Yes. Yes. And so that's what I would say, like... there were nights when, we always had to go for it because that was the thing. And there were nights when, like, be, like, sobbing on stage and you're like, I think this feels real right now. Am I just, like, sobbing on? And then there are other nights when you're like, I'm not quite connected to this moment. And there are some nights you're like, this is so wildly, you know.
Yeah.
But then we'd come off stage and the cast was such a joy. We'd have so much fun that it was very easy to kind of, like... well, it was also quite necessary, I think, because the piece is so dark. But it was very 100%. Easy to just go, all right, thank you, let's forget about that for another night and then come back in. I luckily am not, for the most part, an actor that I am not that meta. I'm not meta. Mm-hmm. And I kind of made quite a concerted effort to, like, not bring it home because it's...
Absolutely. So sorry, you were going to say though, you started talking about the cast and you said Christian someone was brilliant.
Christian Rubeck.
And so was he playing the Henrik role?
Yeah, he was playing Henrik. And he is like one of the nicer human beings in the world. but he plays a very, very convincing villain. He's nasty. Mm. But couldn't be more opposite. Like, he's just an absolutely gorgeous person. And that really, thank God, because...
So you obviously felt very safe, which is wonderful. And yeah. I know that to people who maybe aren't, who are listening, who are interested in theatre and this whole industry, but not in it, that might sound like quite a hyperbolic word to use. But there are a lot of times you don't feel safe doing an 100%. Intense scene.
Oh, there are many, many times that you don't feel safe. And I think that that is the thing that really what this play is looking at, that, you know, this industry is... for the most part, I feel lucky in my career that I haven't had really any or major unsafe moments. Like, I feel lucky, but I know a lot of people that have. And it's all about how far you're willing to push yourself for your artistic integrity. And I certainly have been in a position where I know I've probably said, oh yeah, no, I'll do that because I want it to feel real or something. And you're like, yeah, okay,
but shouldn't have to.
It's not real, and maybe you don't need to do that, or whatever it is, you know. And like, even on a small level, and this is about when you're feeling desperate and you really need to prove yourself and you're almost there and you can just like, what is it that you're willing to do, you know? And this industry is brutal sometimes. You know, people don't, it's like, luckily for the most part, you meet lots of wonderful people, but people will ask you to do things all the time that are really unsafe.
I was told at drama school, there was one director who I remember, I mean, generally wonderful people. I was at Lambda and they were wonderful people. This is not a slur on all drama school teachers or directors by any means. But I had one director who was like, I don't think you're ever going to be able to really play a tragic role because you've had too nice a life. Like, you know, I was a generally very happy person, and I still think I am. And I am definitely privileged in that I had a comfortable upbringing, and I have a family who, you know, I love very dearly. But I just remember thinking, it's acting. I don't think you need to make me feel like I'm less than because I haven't had really traumatic tragedy occur.
That's just such rubbish, isn't it? Exactly, it's acting. And there's this idea of, can you really go there? I mean, like, but then it's like, where's the line? This is the thing with this meta thing. Like, what? So if you're playing a drug addict, what, do you have to go and shoot up to be able to play it? No. You know, like, it's just, it's not, I don't know, it's acting. But there are people out there that, luckily I've not really experienced any of them, but that really want you to see how far you'll, I don't know. Anyway, that's what this play is.
Well, and I think this relates nicely to, I heard that you made a film during lockdown.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like this is similar stuff. You made a horror film. And wasn't the whole premise of the horror film like a director trying to genuinely spook?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Go on, say a bit more about that.
That's really weird as well because we'd made this film before shooting Hedda Gabler came along. And it was only after I sort of thought, oh, this has got some similarities to our film's called Anna Coretta. And it was only when I was explaining this to, I was doing an interview, I don't know if it's to the stage or somebody, and they were like, so tell us about it. I was like,
it's the same story.
This is kind of like the same thing. What? Just like totally hadn't realised. And my boyfriend who I made the film with was like, yeah, it's, that's what I've been saying, isn't it? I was like, I just haven't paid any attention. we made in lockdown, we decided to make a film. We're in Canada at the time and had all of these creative friends sitting around, kind of like twiddling their thumbs, wanting to do something. And my partner's a writer and has directed a bunch of short films. And it was amazing because it was just like film camp. We all wore different hats, you know, we were acting in it. He was writer, director. I acted, produced, did the catering. You know, like, it was really like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Grassroots, how to...
Fun.
How to make a film, which was really fun. It was like back to kind of... It really felt like kind of the creative antidote I'd sort of needed for a while. But it does have funny similarities to shooting Hedda Gabler.
So back on shooting Hedda Gabler, how do you find going from not only TV, but TV that I feel like has been very ensemble driven going like, I am the leading lady now?
Yeah.
Like, did that feel like a pressure, or did it not, within that group and within that brilliant cast that you said, did you feel you were in an ensemble, or did you feel some sort of like weight on your shoulders?
I think like both, in honesty. Like, it was like a lovely group of people who were like all incredible actors and wonderfully supportive. But I did feel the pressure just because... A, the connection to the original play, and everyone knows Hedda Gabler, and it's this, you know, okay, are you playing Hedda Gabler? It's like, kind of, not really, it's a different thing. But then also, like, the character just doesn't leave the stage. So from the top, she enters and then she's on the whole time. And so that was just like, yeah, there's no hiding here.
No.
At all. Yeah. If I, you know, yeah, there was no leaving the stage to, like, even catch your breath or... kind of anything. But it also felt like a challenge that I, at this stage in my career, hadn't realised that I was like really ready for and like wanting. And also, I think that for the most part in my career, apart from the like odd thing, I have always been sort of given like kind of nice, bubbly, like light characters to play.
Yeah.
And it was really, really fun to get stuck into a damaged, thorny mindset. And that challenge was really exciting. So yes, it was hard to get away from the idea that, like, yeah, there was some pressure there, but I was kind of excited by it too, I'd say.
Very welcome pressure.
Yeah.
When you first left Bristol, Vic, what was it you had in your mind that you hoped... What was the journey you thought was going to happen, or you hoped was going to happen?
So I thought that I was going to... Yeah, I mean, Bristol's very, like... their main focus is kind of like classical stuff, classical text, you know, like I always thought like, oh, well, I'll do a Shakespeare play and I'll, you know, like the, I mean, the kind of, I guess I was interested in television and stuff too, but I really thought I would cut my teeth in the theatre, kind of work my way up. I hoped that I'd be at the National sometime, maybe do some RSC, really kind of get into the depths of some Shakespeare. And then, you know, hop over, do a bit of TV here and there, but like really balance it with theatre and play classic roles with integrity and be real sort of.
That's did you also want to be the, you said earlier about like bubbly, you kept being given the bubbly roles. Did you think, oh yes, I'm going to be the like light bubbly character?
No.
Did you have an idea what characters you would play?
No, I don't think I did. But I thought, you know, I'd love to do Juliet. I'd love to do, you know, like all of the things that when you're at drama school and you're, you know, you think of yourself as wanting to play these like leading lady roles. And
yeah.
And I didn't really, we didn't have much screen training at all, really. I mean, I think we had like a week, which was like doing monologues.
Isn't that mad?
Camera thing, you know, and I was scared of screen because I thought that I was like quite overexpressive with my face and that I'd be too big for camera. And I'd sort of been told that when we did that week where I had to do a monologue to screen and stuff. And I was just like, oh, I'm not going to be able to. Theatre's going to be my thing in whatever capacity. I'd love to do a new play at the Royal Court. I'd love to do some cutting edge stuff, all of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then Misfits came, the auditions for Misfits came whilst I was still at drama school. So we were doing our third year shows and I travelled down from Bristol for it because I'd signed with my agents at that point, and I thought it was a complete waste of time, and then went back to Bristol and was like, well, that's never going to come to anything. And then I kept getting these recalls and going down, and really didn't want the job because the character was like, I mean, the whole thing with the character Alicia's power is that it's anyone that touches her wants to have sex with her, and it's just, she was this like really overtly sort of sexual character, and I really thought at the time, like, that's not what I want to be doing, that's not how I want to portray myself as an actress, I don't want to lead with that, like, no. Like, so yeah, each time these auditions came along, like, I kind of had this thing where I sort of half wanted to sabotage them, but then I'd get into the room and the material was really fun and good, and I, and the director and the casting director and all these people, like, I innately wanted to just do my best.
Of course.
But then we'd come out and was like, oh, but I'm scared of this role. And my agents were just like, just trust us. This is going to be a good one. And I was like, but I'm frightened.
I love the idea that you were trying to sabotage, and probably the casting director was like, that's so Alicia.
Yeah.
You were going in with this like reckless attitude that they were like, oh my God, she's perfect.
Well, I thought I was going to do that, and then I just get into the room and then just do the scene, and I couldn't help but just get, because the writing was great and all the rest of it. But like, I did not think that I was going to be doing that kind of a thing first, and it really felt scary to me at that stage. Mm-hmm. And I got the job and ended up leaving a bit early and then starting Misfits, and I was terrified. Like, I was terrified of the role. I was terrified of, you know, like, the screen stuff, because I didn't think that I could do it. Like, it was just all like a huge learning curve. But I just always think about where I'd be without that, and probably nowhere near where I am. Like, it really... That,
I was about to say, so do you have total... I was about to say peace with, but maybe more than peace. Do you... Are you able to look at your particular trajectory and have gratitude for it?
Massively, yeah. Huge gratitude, and huge gratitude to, like, two Misfits... and to Cluck and Bell Films and Julie Harkin and, like, all of those people that kind of took a chance on someone that, like, was really just... I had no idea it was starting. Because that gave, that really did give me my start. It gave me my springboard. And Misfits is still the thing. Like, even though, like, I've had a, you know... I mean, a long career. I'm trying to think how many years it's been now. But, like, since then... And it's still the thing that people stop in the street and they're like, I just rewatched it and like, you know, like, and it, for whatever reason, it came at a moment that was sort of, it was like a zeitgeisty thing and nobody knew it was going to be that. And I owe a lot to it because it just, I don't know, it gave me a springboard.
Yeah.
I feel very lucky to have had, basically.
Well, on that lovely note, shall we... Read the speech that you have picked. Read it gently. I understand.
Read it gently.
It's an intense one. Take it away whenever you're ready.
Here we go. All right. Okay. The truth is that I am trapped in Norway in a house with thick stone walls or on a movie set. Or in a small town by the interstate, a house that never properly gets dark. In every place, the story ends the same, again, 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 with no way to escape. No matter where I go, how many times I leave, I end up trapped. There is no other ending, only failure, madness, suicide. I drive my car into a stranger with a camera. Another stranger takes a photo of me passed out on the floor. They take a photo as I leave the car with bruises. They take a photo when my father dies. They take a photo through the window of the bathroom, of the dressing room, of the hospital. There is no place they will not take a photo. I thought if I came here... I didn't think. I only wanted to get away. To find some kind of change, to change. But now I understand you cannot change. You cannot get away. No matter where you go, some things, they follow you. You follow you. I cannot be anyone but who I am. And so, in my hand, there is a gun. It is heavy, real, maybe the only thing that is. The world around me feels unreal. I feel unreal. I've felt unreal for such a long, long time. I lift the gun. I aim it at myself. I shoot.
Thank you so much, Antonia. That was amazing. Thank you.
Impressive.
Do you feel when you do it now, like, is there already like a real nostalgia?
Oh yeah, big time. I loved it, and it was only a really short run. It was like 3.5 weeks. You know, months were passing.
That's
three
not
and
long
a half
at all.
Weeks, not at all. No, and I feel like we were just getting into our stride when we were finishing.
Hear Me Out is a Lucy Eaton Productions podcast. Music composed by Tristan Kay and artwork by Rebecca Bright. Our heartfelt thanks to the estates and license holders that allow us to read our guests' speech choices. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please, please subscribe, rate, and review. You can follow us on social media at Pod Hear Me Out and enjoy visual clips of the interviews on our YouTube channel. Finally, if you would like to support Hear Me Out, go ahead and click the Patreon link at the bottom of the episode bios.